Special number 4384, Reel 1, Mr. John E. Sutton, August the 4th, 1914 to March the 28th, 1915.
At midnight, August the 4th, 1914. That morning I had left Toronto with a cousin, Fred Long, and two other men bound for Detroit. We had planned to stay 1 week, but returned to Toronto after 3 days. The Canadian cabinet had authorized an expeditionary force of 30,000 men, which had been accepted by England. The Canadian Parliament was not in session, so that formal authorization was delayed. However, an emergency appropriation was provided for equipment and training purposes. The Minister of Militia and Defense issued the call for recruits on August the 9th. All infantry and cavalry units had signed up men in excess of their strength. Canada's peacetime army consisted of one infantry regiment, the Royal Canadian Regiment, which was at half strength, two squadrons of cavalry, the Royal Canadian Dragoons, two batteries of horse artillery, A and B batteries, two companies of garrison artillery, miscellaneous headquarters and service units, total about 2,500 men. The nucleus of the expeditionary force was the militia, similar to the National Guard. Toronto had three regiments of infantry, two of cavalry, and several service units. On August the 12th, I went with a friend named Brakefield and made the rounds of the infantry and cavalry units without success. We finally signed up with the 13th Cavalry Field Ambulance. The following morning, we reported for drill at 9 a.m. This consisted of pairs of men marching along carrying stretchers, putting them down, then picking up the stretchers put down by the men ahead, and so on. Had another session of the same in the afternoon, then went home for the night. The next morning, the same routine, except that the corporal omitted an order to make a turn and marched us into the crowd of onlookers. At this point, Brakefield and myself decided we had had enough. We then visited the orderly room of the 9th Battery Canadian Field Artillery. After listening to our qualifications, they agreed to take us, provided that we were not signed up by some other unit. Next morning, we reported for drill with the 13th Cavalry Field Ambulance. We were told that this unit and others were detailed to guard the Welland Canal. We were to be vaccinated and receive some pay. We two malcontents refused to be vaccinated. The corporal marched us up to the commanding officer and told his story. Captain Saunders asked us what was wrong. We told him we did not like the unit nor the NCOs. He asked for the roster and struck off our names, saying that we had cold feet. We told him that we were joining the 9th Battery Canadian Field Artillery. He said he hoped we would get our heads blown off. We thanked him and went down and signed up with the 9th Battery. We were told to report at Stanley Barracks at 8 a.m. the next morning. The 9th Battery was camped in tents outside Stanley Barracks and alongside the stables of the Toronto Exhibition Grounds. Tents were standard British Army bell tents, named for their shape. They held 8 men with their equipment. We were fortunate to have only 6 men in our tent. They gave us vital statistics and educational backgrounds. We were issued 1 blanket, 1 waterproof sheet, water bottle, haversack, bandolier, and kit bag. No uniforms were available. Peacetime militiamen, chiefly non-commissioned officers, wore blue uniforms trimmed with red. New members wore civilian clothes. I started out with a good brown suit, shoes, shirt, a tie, and a straw hat. Wakefield was assigned as a driver in the right section, A and B guns. I became a gunner in the left section, C and D guns. I was now Gunner John Ernest Sutton. My regimental number was 42597, which stayed with me from now on, regardless of rank. The 9th Battery appeared to be a well-organized unit, overstrength both in officers and men. Equipment was 4 18-pounder field guns of the latest model, each with 2 ammunition wagons. Horses were being obtained from the Toronto Police Force and from the Fire Department, which was being motorized. Horses were stabled in the exhibition stables. Meals were served in the mess room of Stanley Barracks. Food was as good as could be expected from a military caterer. Our day started at the Valley at 6 a.m. and ended at 6 p.m. We were free to leave until 10 p.m. The first night I was 15 minutes late due to streetcar delay. I was stopped at the gate by the infantry sentry, Royal Canadian Regiment. It looked as though I was going to spend my first night in the guard room. Was turned loose about 11 p.m. by the sergeant of the guard with the advice to come in through a hole in the fence whenever I was late again. Drivers were busy attending to their horses, assembling and fitting harness. Gunners were made acquainted with the guns, sights, and other equipment. We then got down to standing gun drill, which went on hour after hour, day after day. Each man had to be able to perform the duties of all members of the gun team. If the elevating or traversing gear was turned in the wrong direction or the wrong hand was used to adjust the sight, the drill was stopped and started over again until all movements were correct. This was to make all functions as automatic as possible. Those who could not make the grade were to be sent to the brigade ammunition column when this was formed. This weeding out applied to the drivers also and would absorb the surplus men from the 4 batteries in the brigade. My friend Wakefield was an early victim, but this transfer meant a promotion to corporal, 2 stripes and a pay increase of 50 cents per day. At the corner of King Street and Strawn Avenue was a pub. Men in uniform were not allowed inside. During business hours, the small grass plot outside the bar window was full of men in uniform who would pass their money to those in civilian clothes inside and take their beers when handed out. At 9 a.m. one Saturday morning, we were lined up at the medical building for vaccination and inoculation. Major Clark, our brigade medical officer, warned that we would feel some effects. He was right, as I felt very woozy almost immediately. Went to the home of my aunt, Ada Long, and slept off the effects. A number of our men were picked up by the police. They returned to the barracks after the police were advised as to the cause of their condition. About the end of August, we harnessed up and pulled out down Front Street through the center of the city to East Toronto Station near the Don River. We had our first casualty. A horse shied away from a streetcar, throwing its rider, who sustained a broken arm. Ammunition wagons, general service wagons, guns, and other vehicles were loaded on flat cars, horses and harness into box cars. Officers and men rode in passenger coaches. Our destination was Star Cartier Camp on the Cartier River, a short distance west of Quebec. Breakfast was served before leaving Stanley Barracks. Each man was given a box lunch to last the rest of the day. Horses were fed by men riding in the boxcars. We were informed that we had been changed from the 9th Battery, 3rd Brigade, to the 8th Battery, 2nd Brigade. We reached our destination about 2:30 a.m. It was raining. There was no platform. Everything had to be handled down wood ramps. Vehicles were unloaded first and ropes stretched between ammunition wagons to serve as horse lines. Illumination was provided by acetylene flares. Then horses were led off. The two horses I was leading shied away from the flares and reared up. I dropped the ropes and let them go. They joined the other horses and I tied them up. Then joined other men in a big tent at the edge of the woods. At dawn, we harnessed up and moved off to camp. After about an hour's ride, we came to an area marked 8th Battery, 2nd Brigade. Set up horse lines, tied horses, and pitched tents. About 9 a.m., Major McDougall, our commanding officer, arrived, followed by the general service wagon. He had rounded up hay and oats for the horses and rations for the men. We watered and fed our horses. The cooks prepared coffee, bread, cheese, and jam were issued. We were then told that we were again the 9th Battery of the 3rd Brigade and that the 8th Battery was waiting to move in. Our major told the messenger in rather strong language that we would move when ready and that the tents would be taken down. This was not done. By noon, we had arrived at our allotted space and set up horse lines, pitched tents, and moved in. Camp cooking was done in open shed with roof. Fuel was wood. Bricks were used to support cooking vessels known as Dixies. Oval in shape, about 16 inches by 12 by 12 inches deep. The cover, about 3 inches deep, was used for frying bacon. Breakfast at 7 a.m., coffee, bread, and bacon. Noon, stew of whatever meat and vegetables was issued that day. 6 p.m., bread, jam, cheese, and coffee. We had acquired a knife, fork, and spoon, also a metal mess tin. The bottom section for stew or coffee, the top for other foods. In fine weather, we ate sitting on the ground, when raining, in tents sitting on our rolled-up bedding. One morning, Major McDougall asked for any complaints. A man stepped forward and said that the coffee was too weak. He was told to get his pay and a ticket back to Toronto. We others were warned that we would get many things worse than weak coffee. There were no further complaints. At this time, we had no uniforms. I had substituted a cap for the straw hat when it fell apart. We had not been sworn in, so that it was easy to tell a man he was fired and send him home. Having no uniforms, mounted drill was out. Gun drill for the gunners, horse kill for the drivers were the order of the day. At times we changed around so that the drivers could learn gun drill and the gunners could substitute for drivers if necessary. I was very fortunate to be in a tent with one other man. Al Stone was wheel driver on D gun. A former British soldier, as were about 50% of our men. He was a wonderful fellow and a big help to one of the youngest men in the battery. I had been designated as his spare. Each vehicle was drawn by three pair of horses, known as lead, spring, and pole teams. Each horse carried a saddle. The driver rode the near or left horse. He carried a short whip. The pole driver wore a leg iron to protect his right leg from the pole. Harness was arranged so that in case of a casualty, any horse could be dropped out with a minimum of delay. Late in September, we were issued uniforms and were sworn in as members of the Canadian Expeditionary Force on September the 23rd, 1914. We received part of the pay for the period of our enlistment. My pay as a gunner was $1 per day plus 10 cents field allowance. We were now able to conduct mounted drills. Tactics were based on the Boer War, this being the last war which was fought by the British. Guns would advance in line of the trot, followed by the firing battery ammunition wagon. Other vehicles halted some distance to the rear. On the command, halt action front, guns were detached from limbers and swung around to 180 degrees. Firing battery wagons would pull up on the left of the guns. Teams would be unhitched. Horses and gun limbers would trot to the rear. We went through the routine of getting line and range to the designated targets, carried out the drill of laying, loading, and firing the guns. Having no ammunition, we got no final results. On one occasion, we fired 10 rounds of blank ammunition per gun, resulting in smoke and noise only. A non-commissioned officer from B Battery, Royal Canadian Horse Artillery, was attached to each gun to assist us in our training. They considered themselves to be rather superior beings, referred to us as ragged-ass militia. I had applied for and was given leave to go to Quebec for one day. Coming out of the orderly tent, all dressed up and shined, I met Major McDougall. He asked me where I was going. I told him, to Quebec, sir, on private business. Looking me over, he said, any man who willfully disobeys King's regulations and orders cannot go to Quebec. I said I had not willfully disobeyed orders. He asked how many times I had heard it read on morning parade that it was against King's regulations and orders to shave your upper lip. I answered, many times, sir, but I have not shaved it. He then said, you may go to Quebec, you may as well shave it. Arrived in Quebec about 9:30 a.m., went to a bank and had them wire my Toronto bank so that I could cash a check. Looked around the city, ending up at the Chateau Frontenac, where I planned to eat lunch. When the dining room opened, I started in, but was told by a military policeman, officers only. I left the lobby, but returned by a stairway, which landed me just to outside the dining room door. This time I got inside when I felt a heavy hand on my shoulder and a gruff voice said, get out, and I mean stay out. I obeyed and ate a good meal elsewhere. A few days later, I was told to report to Major McDougall. He told me I was promoted to bombardier, one stripe, and transferred to the battery commander's party as a signaler, and to act as a spare director man and range finder. This meant an increase in pay of 15 cents per day. The 3rd Infantry Brigade included 3 Highland battalions. They must have got a fresh supply of pipers, judging from the squawks and squeals from the wood to our rear, where they practice. the last week in September, we left Arcadie and rode to the fairgrounds in Quebec. From there, we embarked on the Allan liner, Grampian. The 3rd Brigade numbered about 600 men and 600 horses. We waited in the Gulf of St. Lawrence for several days while other transports were being loaded. Finally, we sailed on September the 29th, 1914. Some 30 transports, one ancient British cruiser, and two destroyers in the convoy. Accommodations and food were better than those in camp. Stables at 6:30 a.m. My duties with four men were to get hay, oats, and straw for the 9th Battery horses from the hold to the stables on the lower deck, and to dispose of stable waste over the side of the ship. After 2 days, the sides of our ship were littered with stable debris. The ship's crew took over this disposal, lowered the debris in large canvas containers, and dumped it at the water's edge. The signal crew spent our time brushing up on or learning the Morse code either by buzzer, lamp, or flags, and the semaphore code by flags. Soft drinks, candy, and cigarettes were sold by the purser's assistant at high prices. After almost 2 weeks at sea, we tied up to a buoy at Devonport, a naval base just west of Plymouth. The Royal Edward, a Canadian Northern liner, was moored to the same buoy. She contained the Princess Patricia, Canadian Light Infantry, named after the daughter of the Duke of Connaught, then the Governor General of Canada. The regiment was composed entirely of recent reservists from British infantry units. After a short training period and leave, the regiment went to France in November 1914. A ship carrying the 1st Lincoln Regiment arrived in port from Bermuda. They had been relieved by the Royal Canadian Regiment, which had been brought up to strength with reservists. The Lincolns were in tropical kit, khaki cotton shorts and tunics, and sun helmets. They and their families left by train for their home depot. The 3rd day in port, a signal was sent ashore from the Grampian, asking permission for half the officers and men to go ashore for 12 hours the next day and the other half the following day. The reply came back, yes, half officers only tomorrow, the other half next day. The receiving signaler omitted the word officers, so the signal handed to our Colonel Mitchell read, yes, half only tomorrow and the other half the next day. I was fortunate to be in the first half. We landed at 9 a.m. to be back by 9 p.m. Went ashore by tender and took the trolley to Plymouth. With another signaler named Ralph, visited Plymouth Hoe and other points of interest. Had two good meals and returned to the ship at 9 p.m. Next morning, the men to go ashore were lined up and ready to leave, when a message came from the British authority that no one was to leave the ship. Trouble started at once as the men broke ranks. Some surged to the port side of the ship, booing Colonel Mitchell, while others on the starboard side lowered the ship's boats. The mutiny flag was raised on the Grampian, and a tender loaded with Royal Marines came alongside. The tender had passed between some of the boats rowing ashore. 8 boats were used, and about 200 men got ashore. About 12 oars were used per boat, and hardly 2 touched the water at the same time. When the boats touched bottom in a cobblestone slip, Oars were dropped and men got out in about a foot of water. They headed up the street, some dropping off at corner pubs and others going up to the trolley into Plymouth. Things quieted down. We were lined up and duly berated. Later, a picket was formed of 48 men and 8 NCOs under command of Lieutenant Craig of the 12th Battery. I was picked as one of the NCOs. We were to go ashore and round up the absentees. Mr. Craig lined up the picket on a side street out of sight of the ship. He said we were to accomplish nothing, marching around as a unit. We split into pairs, taking each side of Main Street leading into Plymouth, visiting pubs and eating places. Any absentees encountered were to be told to be at the tender by 8 p.m. No names were to be taken and no man would be punished or reported on board by 9 p.m. Most of the absentees were back on time. Only about 20 were missing. These were later picked up by the military police and sent to their units on Salisbury Plain. The penalty for these men was loss of pay for the period they were absent. We finally docked and unloaded horses. They were picketed in groups. I was responsible for the horses of the battery commander's party. These were close to a new British battle cruiser, which was preparing for her shakedown cruise and gunnery trials. A gunnery officer told me they expected to start out in a few days. I learned about 3 years later that her shakedown cruise took her through the Panama Canal as part of a cruiser squadron, and that her 15-inch guns were chiefly responsible in sinking a German cruiser squadron, which had destroyed some old British cruisers and gunboats off the Pacific coast of South America. Guns, wagons, and other gear loaded on trains together with half the officers and men. They left that afternoon for Salisbury Plains, about 120 miles away. The following morning, the horses were led by halters only through the streets of Plymouth to the railway station. It was a good distance and there were several delays due to other traffic. At one point, Driver Webb asked me to hold his team of 2 horses while he went into a pub. He moved off before he returned, so that I was now leading 4 horses, approaching the railway station on a bridge over the track. The smoke from below caused Webb's team to partially rear up. I was able to hold them until Lieutenant McDonnell took over Webb's horses. After watering and feeding, the horses were loaded into boxcars. Some men rode in the horse cars. The remainder, including the officers, rode in the passenger coaches. We were given box lunches to last us the rest of the day. Detrained at Amesbury and set out for our camp site at West Elm North, about 10 miles away. A slight rain was falling. At one point, I looked up and saw Stonehenge through the haze. At West Down North, we found that the other party had pitched tents, put up horse lines. Our bedding and kit bags were in place. Forage and rations had been obtained, and the cooks were preparing breakfast. Horses were cared for by the earlier arrivals. We ate breakfast, after which we spent an easy day. The guns, ammunition, wagons, and other equipment had been left at a railway siding about 3 miles away. Equipment belonging to other units was left there under guard by an infantry company. The following day, we led the horses to the guns, etc., harnessed up, and came back to camp as a complete unit again. As we passed another siding, we saw the men of the Canadian Cavalry Brigade cheering Field Marshals Lord Roberts and Lord Kitchener, who were leaving after inspecting some units which had served under them in the Boer War. During the first week, we changed from the Canadian to the more serviceable British uniforms, also to the British rations. Not much difference, except that tea took the place of coffee and mutton was served more often. Early in November, I was given 7 days' leave, spent the time with my family at Herne Bay, visited a few friends, many others were in the British services. The last of the Plymouth absentees was picked up in Bristol after a 3 weeks' period. Paddy Carroll had been a private in the Royal Irish Rifles before going to Canada. He managed a change in uniform, and wearing his old regimental badges, he made his way to Salisbury Plains. There he picked up bullets and shell fragments from the rifle and artillery ranges. Posing as a man back from France, he disposed of his souvenirs for cash or beer in various places and pubs. He was returned to brigade headquarters, tried, and sentenced to 6 months in a military prison in Devizes.